So Andy was at St. Andrew's University in Scotland until 2012, and then he moved to Dresden to become the director of the quantum materials program at the Max Planck Institute for Chemical Physics of Solids. He's a fellow of the Royal Society, fellow of the American Physical Society. In 2011, he won the Mott Medal from the Institute of Physics. So he's going to launch the talk today and the workshop, and let's welcome him.
Thank you. Okay, so thank you, Michel, and thank you for the introduction and also for the invitation. It's the second time I've been here in the Perimeter Institute. It's a really great place and a fantastic thing to have in this part of Canada. So what I thought I would do today would be to tell you about some materials that you may well not be so familiar with. They're at the moment something of a niche field, but I believe there's a lot of opportunity, as it says in the title. So I'm going to try and motivate to you why I think that is. And maybe by the end of the talk, if I've done a good job, you'll have some interest in them yourselves. So work these days is never done alone, of course. And here are the collaborators on the particular projects I decided to select for today's talk. And basically speaking, they're listed here in alphabetical order. Basically, they consist of theorists like Maritz Haverkort, Deepa, Joel, Thomas, Helga, and Burkhardt. We have, really importantly, sample growers, Jung-Hyun and Pallavi. We have Phil King's group from St. Andrews, including Federico Mazzola and our joint student, Veronica Sunko. They do photo emission. And then we also have measuring people from my group, Nabanila Nandi, and a very strong collaboration with the group of Philip Mull, who, as some of you will know, is a specialist in microstructuring single crystals of interesting materials for custom designed experiments. So everybody there has made a valid contribution to what we're doing, but I would particularly like to concentrate today on telling you about the achievements of three young people. It's one of the great pleasures at the moment in Dresden is that we have a fantastic group with a number of really good young scientists. So one part of the talk will be about the work, or the new stuff about the work of Nabanila Nandi, a PhD student of mine. Some of the interesting new theory is by Thomas Scafidi, who was a graduate student at Oxford with Steve Simon and is now a Moore postdoc at Berkeley. And the photo emission work from the group of Phil King was essentially led by Veronica Sunko. So here's the basic plan. I'll tell you a little bit about what Dellafossites are, why they have their strange name, and what they look like chemically. Then I thought I would choose from the work we're doing one example of physics that we can access by studying the bulk properties of the materials, and that is in particular making use of their very high purity to look for signatures of electron hydrodynamics or a viscous contribution to electrical transport. So of that, the electron shear viscosity work was published last year, but the stuff about the odd or the Hall viscosity is a new preprint theoretically, and these are experiments which are in progress at the moment. This work is also new, and this was a real surprise to us. We made some strange observations about the nature of surface states in these materials as studied by photo emission, and believe we've now understood them, and that by understanding them, we've uncovered something which might be of broader significance particularly to the community of people working on interfaces and heterostructures. So I thought it would also be interesting to give you an idea of what we're doing there. Okay, so why the name? I haven't put it up there, but natural Dellafossite is copper iron O2. And it's a naturally occurring mineral, and when it was discovered, it was named in honor of a guy, I think he was Gabriel Delafosse, who was a French mineralogist from the 19th century, if I get my date right. They are layered materials, They're based on in-plane triangular lattices. Some of you here will be superconductivity aficionados who will remember the superconductor that you could make by intercalating sodium cobalt oxide with water. This structure is very similar to the sodium cobaltate structure, but the stacking sequence is different. Okay, so they're both triangular, fundamentally triangular layered metals. In the Dilophosites, there are many insulators and semiconductors, but only relatively few metals. So it's the metals we're talking about today, and what we're thinking of there is a stacked sequence of triangular coordinated noble metals, platinum or palladium, interspaced or intercalated with transition metal oxygen octahedra. But if you're used to the cuprates, the strange thing here is that these octahedra are edge sharing rather than corner sharing. So in other words, they're sitting on their side. The apical oxygen is not sitting above and below the transition metal, it's sitting between them. And this kind of fundamental structural unit gives you a really interesting situation because, as I'll show you later, the noble metal layers support simple conduction bands in which the conductivity is nearly free electron-like. So the Fermi velocities of these bands are within about 10 or 15% of the free electron value. In between that, though, as you would expect, the transition metal oxide layers are strongly correlated. In the case of cobalt and ruthenium, we have to use slightly roundabout routes to understand that the relevant U is around about 4 electron volts for cobalt and around about 2 electron volts for rhodium. I said ruthenium by mistake there, for rhodium. But in the case, and that is because the way the electron counting works and the way the bands sit, even the LDA predicts those layers to be insulating in the absence of on-site correlation. Right? Then, if you're wanting to understand the finer details of the electronic structure better, you discover that you have to put these kind of U's into your calculation. But it's a kind of, if you like, a second-order effect. That's not the case for chromium. So chromium 3 plus is a spin, and I should say also that cobalt 3 plus and rhodium 3 plus in the low spin configuration lead to non-magnetic metal. That's not the case for chromium. Chromium 3 plus sits at spin 3 halves, and indeed what you find is that you get a magnetically ordered metal when you make the one with chromium. And the electron counting, if you just do a straight LDA calculation, the electron counting then would put the Fermi level in the chromium bands, so you wouldn't have the same kind of conduction bands as the other materials at all. But that's not what you see. What you see is this magnetic Mott insulating layer where the weight of the bands has been pushed way down so that, the conduction band is palladium-based, and that conduction band is then existing in the presence of weak coupling with the magnetic order, which is a slightly more complicated version of 120-degree magnetism. So I'm not going to... I decided I wouldn't say concentrate the talk today on the chromate, but that's a very interesting situation because it's as if nature has given you this free electron, Mott insulating, free electron heterostructure. And you can play a lot, and there's a lot of physics, I think, to be learned about the coupling between those conduction band electrons and the Mott insulating bands that they must coexist with. I say here that it's strongly two-dimensional conduction. In all of these metals, the measured resistive anisotropies are of order 1,000. So you can be really thinking of these as 2D in-plane conductors. Now, I should say, I welcome questions, by the way, because this obviously isn't a topic that's familiar to many people. So if I'm forgetting to say something important, you should just ask. So what really caught my attention when I first learned about the properties of these materials from my good friend Yoshi Maino in Japan was that the conductivity of them is really extremely high. I'm not going to claim to you that we have a good microscopic understanding of that, but I want to try and contextualize it so you realize what I mean by high. So here's a graph of just room temperature conductivity for the moment. naming, you know, standard things like the alkali elemental metals and a couple of what are famous as the most highly conducting oxides that people have known. And then you get a group that you can't label on this scale down here. They include aluminium, copper, silver, gold, all the kind of classic, really highly conducting elements. Amazingly, palladium cobaltate and platinum cobaltate sit right in the middle of that bunch of extremely highly conducting metals at room temperature. And even more amazingly, you should take into account that because of the relative low density of noble metal ions in the material, the carrier concentration is about a factor of 3 smaller than the carrier concentrations of these comparators. So in terms of proper monovalent metals, the Dilophosites are actually the most conducting per carrier metals known at room temperature. And the idea that you're getting that in a two-dimensional oxide is very surprising, at least based on experience. These are resistivities at room temperature of a couple of micro-ohm centimeters. Most oxides that we're used to will have a factor of 50 higher resistivity at room temperature than that. So just empirically, that's a surprising fact. And not only are they very good conductors at room temperature, you can grow them with excellent resistance ratios. These resistance ratios can be between 100 and 400, depending on what you do. But I should emphasize that no matter what you're doing, you're not paying particular attention. There's no post-growth purification processes or anything being applied. And in spite of that, the low temperature resistivity in palladium cobaltate is a few nano-ohm centimeters. In other words, the in-plane mean free paths are tens of microns. So you're getting me, and now, again, if some of you in here may be interested in semiconductor physics, if you converted that mean free path to gallium arsenide at fractional quantum Hall densities, that would be a mobility of just under 2 million centimeters squared per volt second. So these are, something that took you 25 years of processing to achieve in semiconductor heterostructures is just happening when you take these crystals, in the case of palladium cobaltate, out from the flux that you grew them in. So that's already, from a material point of view, to me, just extremely surprising. And I'm going to leave you with that as a thought. We're still trying to work out exactly why it happens. It's not so obvious to us. Yeah, Bruce. Yeah. So the question, in case you didn't hear behind, is there evidence for disorder? No, we have not. You get very good crystal patterns, right? But disorder at this sort of level, or even 10 times, you know, so that mean free path, if you work on the approximation, it's always interesting how you interpret a mean free path. But let's imagine that you said that the mean free path defined was the radius of a circle, and that a 20 micron mean free path meant that there were no defects inside that circle. That's 10 to the 10 atoms, right? And so then the question is, I know what you're going to ask next. Yeah, fine, that sounds completely chemically implausible. Are there defects at a far higher density, and are the electrons just missing those defects? Yeah. That could well be because, as I'll mention in a minute, we have measured the Hasse-Van-Alphen oscillations in all these materials, and you typically find that the Hasse-Van-Alphen mean free paths, while long, are a factor of 10 to 20 smaller than the resistive one. So that tells you there's quite a lot of small angle scattering going on, and it makes you think that there might be significant disorder in the transition metal oxide layers with some form of hetero effect. But it's an excellent point, and I'll show you at the second half of the talk the amazing things that Veronica Sunko has already achieved in the first half of her PhD. What she now wants to do is to go and do controlled electron, high-energy electron irradiation of these materials to know what density of point defects we're putting in to try and understand this issue. So the other thing that I really like about Dilophosites is that the electronic structure is fantastically simple. Just one band crosses the Fermi level. These things are half filled to within experimental precision, so it's just what you would expect from the basis of valence counting. The Fermi surface is, that's the calculated one for palladium cobaltate. This is our measurements of the measured one for platinum cobaltate. I could have interchanged it, you know, the photo emission and the band calculations agree pretty well for all the materials. And when you look back across the history of what we work on, it's not so often that you get the chance to work on something where you just have one band to worry about. And that's also an extremely welcome simplification. The other thing to notice is that these Fermi surfaces look pretty nested. There's no evidence for density wave formation. Whether that's related or not to this fact, I don't know. But observationally, these materials are, a nested Fermi surface at half filling in a triangular lattice would not give you a commensurate density wave. If there was going to be a density wave at this filling, it would have to be incommensurate. Whether or not that's a disincentive to density wave formation, I'm not sure, but it's certainly a. So, very simple, as I say. I'm concentrating on photo emission in this talk, but particularly because these are polar surfaces, you have to be very careful to cross-check what you think you're getting from photo emission of bulk states. And we're able to do that by performing de Haast-Van-Alphen measurements on each of these materials. The de Haast-Van-Alphen frequencies are very large. They're 30 kilotesla because it's a monovalent metal. That makes them, they should be very hard to see. The fact that we're seeing them at all, again, is a testament to pretty high levels of purity, even if not ones talking about a 20 or 30 micron mean free path. So if I do manage to interest you in the topic in the talk today, I've just published a review article I wrote to educate myself on the history of the field. The interesting thing about this is it wasn't such a hard review article to write because as of mid-2016 when I submitted it, there were only 75 papers that had ever been published on any of these metals. So it really is quite a young field in that sense, although the fact that these were extremely good metals was established by the DuPont chemists back in the early 1970s. So it was a field that was discovered. I think we didn't really have the technology to investigate it properly at the time, so it was dropped, and then it was retaken up mainly by Yoshi Maino's group about 10 years ago. So that's the preamble. You have this very simple Fermi surface, and you have amazing conductivity. Now we're going to go on to some of the physics. So it would be nice to understand in depth why the conductivity was so high. Of course, that's our long-term goal. But even before you understand that, when you have numbers of that nature, there are ways you can try and take advantage of them to do novel experiments. So this is what I'm going to talk to you about now, and it's the search for hydrodynamic flow in electron fluids or electron bands. So because, if you're like me, you're a solid-state physicist who may not have done a tremendous amount of study of hydrodynamic flow, here's a quick primer. If you had a two-dimensional pipe, let's just work in two dimensions for simplicity, and the pipe's empty, and let's think for now, because we're quantum guys, let's think about normal helium-3, a Fermi fluid of helium-3 flowing through a two-dimensional channel. Now, although the helium-3 atoms are scattering like crazy from each other in the center of that channel, all of that scattering doesn't give you any resistivity or any flow resistance because the helium fluid is exchanging momentum with itself and the overall momentum isn't relaxed. In hydrodynamic flow like this, the only momentum relaxation is at the pipes, the walls of the pipe at the edge of the system. So the amount of flow resistance you're going to get is going to depend on the degree of transverse coupling of particles or an element of the fluid near the center to the edge. That means that you end up getting a quadratic flow front where the velocity is the highest in the middle of the pipe and an overall flow resistance which is determined by this transverse coupling which we often call the shear viscosity. Now, counterintuitively for us, because eta is a transverse coupling, in helium-3, the longer the mean free path, the less scattering which is going on inside the fluid, the more effective the transverse coupling, so the longer the mean free path, the greater the flow resistance, and not the other way around. Now, anybody who's worked a lot with dilution fridges is at least implicitly aware of this effect, because the reason that you can't buy a fridge that goes, a dilution fridge that cools you to below about 7 millikelvin, isn't anything fundamental. It's because by then the mean free path of helium is so long that the viscosity of helium-3 is about the same as motor oil, and you have capillaries that you're trying to force the fluid through to make your fridge work. You just don't have the pumping power to make the fluid go around your circuit. So that, but that's very unusual for us. And the point, though, is that we're used to talking about mean free path, as I'll tell you in a minute. That mean free path that we're used to talking about is a property of the material the electrons are flowing through. The mean free path relevant to the viscosity is the mean free path of the flowing fluid. Right? So you have to make a distinction between these two mean free paths. I'm putting that a little bit more explicitly. Let's imagine that we're now pushing the electrons through a 2D channel. Our channel isn't empty, it's got a lattice in it. If the lattice was perfect and we were at very low temperatures, that wouldn't be a problem. But no lattices are perfect. They have defects shown in the red dots here. So what you have going on is a lot of momentum relaxing scattering events in the bulk. So you don't necessarily need to reach the boundaries to dump your momentum out. And it's all then a question of numbers. This is a nasty joke about our field, which, like all nasty joke, good nasty jokes, is too close to the truth for our comfort. In almost everything we've ever thought about studying, the dirt in this material is so high that the boundaries are essentially irrelevant. All the scattering is dominated by the internal scattering in the material. So the viscous term of the electrons is not unobservable or not easily observed, playing no big role. And so we treat that with another of the great solid-state physics techniques. We just ignore it altogether. And by that, I mean that if you use you go to Zeynman's book or something, and you use expressions for resistivity that are based on the Boltzmann equation and the relaxation time approximation, the only collisions that are being thought of in that theory that you're reading about are the momentum relaxing ones from the impurities and the phonons and everything else. In principle, as I'll show you in a moment, it's possible to take the momentum conserving collisions into account as well. It's just that traditionally that's not done. So, and it's not a problem because taking them into account makes no practical difference. Now, there's always a kind of 0.00101% of people who think beyond the standard approximations. And usually, as far as I can see, they were working in the Soviet Union before I was born. So I was born in 1964, so this one just counts. And Gertzi wrote some famous papers on this problem, where he pointed out that, as I alluded to a minute ago, you have to think of three length scales when you're thinking about electron flow in small objects. You should think about the momentum relaxing mean free path, which is the standard one that solid state physicists think about. You should also think about the momentum conserving mean free path, which is the, say, electron-electron scattering events within the electron fluid. And you should think about the width. And if, as in every known material, you're in this regime where the smallest length scale in your problem is the momentum relaxing mean free path, then you've got ohmic theory, ohmic transport, and standard Boltzmann theory, as we always use it, applies. If, however, you're able to make the momentum conserving mean free path the shortest of the three length scales, if you were to take that to its extreme, you would have a hydrodynamic theory where the electrical resistivity would be determined only by the fluid viscosity. Here, the electrical resistivity is determined entirely by the solid's resistivity. Right? Here, it would be only to do with the viscosity of the electrons. And if you were really in this regime, you could write down Navier-Stokes equations for standard hydrodynamic transport and work out what was going on in your electron fluid. This is an extremely hard regime to reach. With the benefit now of hindsight, it may have been reached in the closest electronic analog that we know of to the Dellafossites in three dimensions, which is alkali metals. So alkali metals have a single closed Fermi surface, which is why they're much loved of solid-state physics textbooks. And these guys did very clever experiments on carefully annealed potassium wires, and they were able to make single crystal wires drawn out to get them down, but the technology would only allow them to go down to a wire diameter of about 90 microns. Right? But even so, they have some observations in there which would be easiest to understand if the electron viscosity was playing a role in what they were seeing. But they were so unconfident about it that the paper, the PhysRev letter, ended with a question mark. It said, observation of the Goetze effect, question mark. Now, whether the referees forced them to put that in or not, I don't know, but the paper is kind of largely ignored. There was some fantastic work done by Mollenkamp and collaborators, notably in the 1990s, on semiconductors, very pure semiconductors. But again, that kind of came and went and was widely ignored. And then last year, three groups, two on graphene and us on the Dellafossite, had simultaneously had the thought that if you're beginning to get these enormous mean free paths that you can see resistively, then maybe the hydrodynamic regime of Goetze would be accessible. So the work was very different in the three cases, entirely independent, and I certainly didn't know about either of these other pieces of work, but it turns out they were submitted almost simultaneously and published in the same issue. So let me tell you not about the graphene stuff, but about what we did to try and investigate. So what we decided to use was focused ion beam sculpting, which is the technique that focused ion beams have been around for a long time. But Philip Mahl, our colleague at Dresden, is one of the pioneers of showing just how versatile a technique that can be for patterning of what to us are interesting materials. So this is crystal mounting by somebody with steady hands from my generation. I've probably mounted 1,000 crystals in this way in my time, right? And you feel very proud of yourself because you think you've developed almost watchmaker skills. This isn't even the pushing it to its final extent. If you use 10 micron wires, you've probably got 10 to 15 micron spatial resolution with what your hands can do after you've practiced. Still always amazed me. So you feel proud of yourself, but in the end, microscopically, that's still a little bit like taking a big chunk of silver paint in your hand and throwing it against the wall. You know, it's just, you're splatting on the contacts. You have really very little control of what you're doing. So the 21st century approach, if you have a nice focused ion beam, is to be able to do it like this. And actually, both of these devices were made by Nabanila. We made her suffer before we gave her the good stuff to work with. And so this is a single crystal. You see the characteristic angle of a hexagonal or a triangular lattice. This is a single crystal of, this, in this case, platinum cobaltate. She's, first of all, evaporated gold all over it. Then she cuts it into this shape with a conducting channel exactly specified to have the characteristic that she wants. And then you can blast from the top to take the gold off from where you don't want it. So what you end up with are rather large contact pads, all including the crystal, necking down to very small voltage probes and a really well-defined channel. And because we are, you know, the Max Planck resource means that we have one of these FIBs just for the use of our group, we now basically do all our transport measurements on crystals prepared in this way or technique very similar. And I should really, again, say Philip Mahl is, in my view, the pioneer of these techniques, and we've learned a lot from him in the experiments we're trying to do. So if you've got the ability to make samples like this, then you can try and do essentially very directly the experiment that Goetze predicted somebody should do back in 1963. You can take a crystal, this is palladium cobaltate, this one made by Philip, you define that same current-carrying channel. You measure its resistance on with two pairs of contacts to make sure everything's good. Then you half the width. So here you're seeing it was originally 60 microns wide. Now it's 30 microns wide, and you put new contacts in, so you have same contact geometry but a half-width sample. Measure its resistance again, half the width again, measure again, et cetera, et cetera. I won't spend too long on this because it's published and you can go and read about it. But when you then plot the resistance that you've measured for this channel, you get the black dots, which are shown on this curve, on this graph, and you plot them in dimensionless ways. So you plot the resistivity of the channel that you've studied divided by the resistivity of the material infinite width, and you plot it as the inverse width of your channel normalized to the mean free path. And what you then get in the great thing about that is if you use the traditional Boltzmann transport theory that we're all used to, there are no free parameters left in how you do that. And that was something pointed out by Banacker back in the early 90s. So with no free parameters, your answer is the blue curve. If you modify the theory to allow for the momentum conserving collisions that would give you a viscous term, for reasonable parameters, you get the red curve. And of course, the red curve gratifyingly matched the data a lot better than the blue curve. And it did it, if you blow up here, you see it's doing it in a number of important details. So the data sit above the universal curve for very narrow wires. They sit below the universal curve for much thicker wires or thicker channels, wider channels. And the data and the model follow that rather well, and they also cross the universal prediction in about the right place. So it's only one graph, and maybe it's ambitious to make a big claim like hydrodynamic transport based on one graph, but there were enough details in that graph to make us confident enough to do that. And the paper contains a lot of other characterizations of the material to justify the fact that none of this is due to damage scattering. This is all due to boundary scattering. So that was what we could do up to what we published a year ago, and we were pleased with that. But what we realized was that this is all for data analyzed. Data that's being analyzed here was taken in zero applied field. What would be really good for an experimental group would be to have an equivalent of this hydrodynamic Boltzmann theory, but with an applied field, because for us, the field is a knob that we can turn extremely easily. So if you do that, then you open up the idea, and these are graphs taken from a paper to make a view graph look pretty. I don't think they're very comprehensible, so don't spend too much time thinking about them. The important thing to realize is that if you've got a field on, then there's a transverse component to the viscosity as well as the longitudinal. So you have the shear viscosity and an additional viscosity called the odd viscosity or the Hall viscosity to deal with. That's been discussed using Navier-Stokes approaches by a couple of groups in the literature recently. But Thomas Scafidi did what was most useful for us, and he recast the modified Boltzmann theory to solve it for the field. And when you're doing that, you then have the ohmic region to think about that Goetze had described that I talked about before. Then the hydrodynamic region. You also have to think a region called the ballistic one, where you've made your sample or all the length scales smaller than any of the mean free paths. So here's the prediction for how a Boltzmann fluid would look like in the ballistic region when you apply a field. So the green line is just no matter how wide your sample is, that's the ohmic prediction. And then you start to restrict your channel size and you start to see what happens, where this time you're normalizing your channel width to the cyclotron radius, which becomes another relevant length scale. And basically you see that at zero applied field, you get the resistivity rising. That's the effect that we were analyzing before. Then the resistivity in the field goes up, reaches a peak, and comes down dramatically. And there's a very well-defined kink when the width equals twice the cyclotron radius. And that's understandable because then you're thinking about helical tracks. And the cyclotron diameter, if that falls below the width of the wire, then you're cutting off the sample from the electrons from being able to sample that extra boundary scatter. Right. So that was known before. And Thomas reproduced those results. In the magnetoresistance, when you go into a hydrodynamic regime where you give an increased importance to momentum conserving collisions, it's not that spectacular. You get similar things going on. But you see everything washes out. So you no longer have this special part place at twice the cyclotron diameter, because there's other scattering going on than simply, which is distorting the way you're able to make those cyclotron orbits. So in the end, we have data, and I'm confident that we'll be able to take this magnetoresistive theory and go and do some analysis with it. But what was a surprise from Thomas's work, there he is, he deserves photo credit here. What was a surprise from his work was what happens to the Hall resistivity. So the Hall resistivity is affected a lot by going into the ballistic and hydrodynamic regimes. And I don't want to push this too hard. There's lots of parameters here. I just want to emphasize the following. What he realized is that if you are dominantly hydrodynamic, then down at very low fields, the predicted viscous contribution to the Hall effect opposes the normal one. So you get a rho xy, which is smaller than the one you would have expected. If, however, the viscous term isn't important, and you merely get very narrow, so you go into the ballistic region, which lots of people have studied elsewhere, the low field Hall effect, the low field rho xy, is going to grow considerably above the ohmic prediction. So armed with that, we decided to do some experiments to compare the resistance, to take a constant width sample, and to compare how the high field Hall effect looked to the Hall effect really near zero field, because that was going to be able to give us a hint whether we were entering a ballistic or a hydrodynamic regime in these Hall experiments. So this is a boring graph. This is the real Hall data from one of these samples. Nice single band, so everything's nice and simple. Minus 15 Tesla to plus 15 Tesla. With the naked eye, you just have a perfect straight line, right? So at least we know what we're measuring. You can then do a fit through that straight line so you can get its gradient. And then you look carefully at what the gradient looks like in the little region near zero field. And you can't resolve it on this graph, but you are able to see that, again, within your signal to noise, it's linear down there, the Hall voltage is a function of field. But consistently, we see that the gradient there is 10% or so less than the gradient out at the high field region. And this is work in progress. This is Nabanil and Nandi's thesis work. It's too early. We haven't done all the checks we would like to. But the fact that we consistently see the answer, which is qualitatively predicted by the hydrodynamic contribution, is at least hopeful that this is an observation of the viscous contribution to the Hall effect. So we'll see. Nabanil is currently building another cryostat to extend her measurements to a different range of parameters. So that was the bulk stuff. Michelle, we started late. I'm not sure how much of my time I've used. Okay, good. And that then leaves some time for questions. But and is there questions from anybody here now? Okay, so now I'll go on to the surface stuff. So that was all the bulk. Now here's a question of what happens when you're no longer worried about what's going on in the bulk, but you're worried about what's going to be happening at the surface, which you can access with photo emission. So as said before, now what we're going to concentrate on is the electronic structure associated with the cobalt oxide octahedra. So in palladium cobaltate, the way the band counting works out, the existing crystal field split in bulk splits the levels like so, and this multiplet, every band in here is full, so that you've got insulating cobalt oxide layers in bulk. However, this is a polar surface, so if you cleave the thing so that you're presenting the top cobalt oxygen octahedra to the world, that top layer ends up being, roughly speaking, you can think of it by being charged negatively by half an electron. Because of that, that means that this multiplet of bands is not full, and you predict just heuristically, qualitatively, so metallic surface state. And you do indeed see them. So one of the great things about the Dellaforsites is that the photo emission quality is fantastic. So here's the bulk density functional theory just put in a two-dimensional Brillouin zone. It predicts the conduction band that you see crossing the Fermi level. It predicts another broad band based on the palladium bulk states which doesn't touch the Fermi level, but again, you see very beautifully in the photo emission. But the photo emission is also showing you clear evidence for states reaching the Fermi level, which aren't predicted by the bulk calculation at any KZ. When you look at those in more detail for platinum cobaltate, you see that they're split. So it's not one band, it's two surface bands reaching the Fermi level split. And you also see that it's qualitatively identical for the surface states in palladium cobaltate. Right? So in both cases, you're seeing the bulk electronic structure here, and then these two surface states along this particular cut being studied. So if you then look at the surface Fermi surface, and this is from platinum cobaltate, you see that you have the bulk Fermi surface outside, very faint if you can see it, and then you have the two surface states, one's hexagonal, one is nearly circular, and you can go away and do spin-resolved photo emission, and you discover that, as you suspected might be happening, these are Rashba-like in their spin texture. So you have an opposite spin circulation texture for the inside surface Fermi surface than for the outside one. And then you go to a band calculation. These days, good people can do proper band calculations where they terminate the surface and they just study what's happened because of the symmetry breaking that went on there. And you realize gratifyingly that the DFT calculation, just numerical calculation, gets about the right answer. It gives you the right spin texture, and it's able to tell you that you get about the right splitting once you've fitted a couple of parameters at least, and that you compare rather nicely to experiment. But both the experiment and the theory give a pretty large Rashba split here. And I'm going to put some more words on that soon. But in the history of the field, that's actually quite surprising, and that's what caught our attention. And you can still carry on using your density functional theory to get more information about this, because you can examine your calculation of the surface bands which are crossing the Fermi level, and you can plot them in a way which gives a different weight to them depending on the amount of weight they have from the uppermost cobalt oxide layer. So that calculation tells you that the bands that are crossing the Fermi level, weight-wise, are completely dominated by just the single terminating cobalt oxide layer. It also puts a quantitative number on a scale of the split, which is as much as 70 millivolts in part of the Brillouin zone. And that's a surprise, because that's the full atomic value of cobalt spin orbit coupling. And the reason it's a surprise is that many, many other cases of Rashba-like split surface states have been seen. But in basically all of them, the observed split that you're seeing is only a small fraction of the atomic value. So anything which has a big Rashba surface state split is based on an extremely heavy atom with a couple of electron volts worth of raw spin orbit. So why were we getting an observation of all the spin orbit coupling of cobalt? So just to remind you then, this is well-known stuff. If you have a bulk band, you have an in bulk in an inversion respecting crystal like these, then you have two symmetries to worry about, inversion symmetry and time reversal, and they ensure spin degeneracy and that everything just has to be a single band. If you go to the surface, you break inversion, so you allow a spin split of these bands. But in order to get the spin split, you need not just the inversion breaking, but some spin orbit coupling to give you some reason for the split to take place. So not happy just to accept the results of a numerical calculation, my current graduate student, Veronica Sunko, said she really wanted to understand this in more depth. And she could agree that there were two contributions here, the spin orbit coupling and the inversion symmetry breaking. But she realized, and by reading the literature and doing her own thinking, that the energy scale of the two effects is absolutely vital in what you see. So in other words, you start out with, in two cases, strong inversion symmetry breaking and weak inversion symmetry breaking. In bulk, everything's degenerate. If the inversion symmetry breaking at the surface is very strong, then you're going to qualitatively get a huge split of your levels due to that inversion break. If things, other things work out right, you can develop an orbital angular momentum separation between those two levels. But then if the spin orbit coupling is a smaller scale than that energy scale, it's like you add the spin orbit term to the Hamiltonian after the big split. Yep. Yes. In many, many materials, it's not that strong. So, it's. I'm going to try and put numbers on it in a minute. What we're getting here is that the surface inversion breaking scale that's of relevance to these bands is about 150 millivolts, right? And, you know, and the copper, you know, you can, for, since time immemorial, people have studied, say, the 111 surface of copper, right? And there, I guess, the inversion breaking scale is, 10 EV or something. To everything we can do on it, it seems to stay perfect. Yeah, definitely. And you know, these are possibly due to the high conductivity is also due to the fact that this is a really strongly bonded system in plane, if you like. So strong, it depends on what you mean. You know, there's a real number to put in here. And basically what we're then saying is it strong relative to the raw spin orbit term of the atom concerned, giving you the metallic state? So this is the definition of strong. Weak would be that you have a big spin orbit energy scale, but then you don't go into separate L states, you're going to go into J state. And if the inversion scale is much less than that spin orbit scale, then the splitting that you'll end up seeing for your Rashba-like states will be dominated by whatever the inversion breaking scale is and not by the raw spin orbit coupling of the atom. There's another thing to think about in this simple thing. If you've got the angular momentum split, then the prediction here is that you will have the same orbital angular momentum as you reverse the spin angular momentum in the two bands, whereas the prediction here is that both spin and orbital angular momentum will reverse. And a lot of this thinking was in the literature before in these papers, but certainly they're pretty hard to understand. I think Veronica did a great job in categorizing this in simple language that she could then attempt to explain to me, right? And so then the next question is, it looks as if then we're in this situation where we must need some rather big number on the inversion symmetry breaking scale. How do you get that? And here we go back to this structural thing where the fact that these octahedra lie on their edge is so important. Because in that case, imagine you're trying to make a hop from cobalt to cobalt in this surface layer, the hopping that determines the bands that we've been looking at. You can do that in three ways. You could go directly cobalt to cobalt, or you could go through this purple oxygen or this blue oxygen. But if you look at it carefully, you realize that the purple oxygen sits above the cobalt and the blue one sits below the cobalt. So the surface inversion breaking is going to give you a big energy scale effect on those two hopping paths. If you had vertical octahedra, the two hopping paths would both be in plane, so the inversion breaking wouldn't be giving you a big energy scale associated with that hop. And so Veronica went to the band guys as a first-year PhD student and told them what they should be calculating. So they went back and calculated it. And they realized that the average hopping energy is about 360 millivolts. And you can very straightforwardly estimate the anisotropy. And straight away, you get that there's a hopping-related inversion symmetry breaking scale of about 150 millivolts here. So that then is post facto evidence of how you could justify that both of these compounds might be in the correct limit to see the bare cobalt spin orbit coupling coming into the Rashba split. Now, coming back to the fact that about the spin and orbital angular momentum stuff, you can try and check that because you can redo your photo emission with circular dichroism. And that is loosely supposed to have a relationship with the orbital angular momentum of the states. And the important thing there is that what we see is that on both sides of the Fermi surface, obviously, the sign changes from one to the other because the orbital, in-plane orbital term has. But both of these bands on either side have the same orbital angular momentum, whereas we showed you earlier on that they have the opposite spin. So again, this is consistent with that basic level split. But now here's the bit. Up to now, it was nice, but maybe arguable whether it was important or not. What we or she realized after doing this analysis is that the inversion symmetry breaking scale that you get here is bandwidth related. So if you make a change and put a heavier transition metal atom in, although the spin orbit is bigger, the inversion term is also going to get bigger. So there would be a chance of changing to a heavier transition metal atom and getting a bigger Rashbaugh split still. And basically, I think the mechanism's validity stands or falls on that observation. If you can do that, you know what you're doing. So luckily, palladium rhodate existed. No single crystals existed. So Shun-Hyun Kim and Pallavi Kushwaha managed to grow new crystals for this experiment. And sure enough, they went away and did the experiment. And just qualitatively, you see that the split in the rhodate is much bigger. And you can go out to the K point where technicalities, where it's easier to really quantify it. And you see that it goes from about 60 millivolts in palladium cobaltate to 150 millivolts in palladium rhodate. The next one in the chain would be to try and grow palladium iridate, which we're now going to go and do. It could be that if we're able to do that, we'd be able to take the size of this split to really, really big. And the significance of this for us is that this is a kind of combination of chemistry and kinetic energy giving you the energy scales that you need. So that is something that when you know about it, you can think about implementing when you're trying to do surface, but particularly interface engineering. So a lot of people these days are working on getting spin textures in electron gases at the interface between MBE-grown layers. But we were very surprised at the insight that came out of this, because we reckon that we now have ways to think about how to engineer those layers to tailor the Rashbaugh splitting that we should be able to produce. And Phil King and Peter Vall at St. Andrews are setting up an oxide MBE machine at the moment. So one of the things they're going to go and try and do is to work with crystals, with thin films, based on this Delafossite structure. So time's nearly up. My voice is nearly up. I hope the conclusions are reasonably clear from what I've said, so I'll leave you to read them. And stop talking, and thanks very much for your attention.
Which plane is for?
Oh, yeah. Very good. Very good. Yeah. In fact, when you cleave Delafossites, they have two cleavage planes. They can cleave to present the cobalt oxide layer or the palladium or platinum layer. You see both. I just concentrated on the results from the cobalt layer at the moment. The palladium or platinum layers have actually a stoner instability in the surface state. So you get a single spin ferromagnetic-like surface state from them. And that's work that we're in the process of writing up now. But the honest thing is that sometimes you get a cleave where you see you're dominated by the cobalt oxide layer. Sometimes you'll get one where you're dominated by the palladium or platinum layer. But most of the time, you're actually seeing both at once, because the cleave isn't perfectly controllable. And the photo emission, the light spot, is big enough that you sample both. Luckily, where the bands cross in K-space is rather different, so you don't run into complications of interpretation when you're trying to work.
Are there any oxygen defects in the cobaltite there, or do you think that it's pristine?
We believe it's fairly pristine now. There would be presumably surface diffraction and things you could do to try and nail that down. But it is a highly layered compound, right? I mean, its weakest bond is definitely the bond between the cobalt oxygen octahedra and the noble metal. And in fact, the chemists make a big deal of this, that structure also from the noble metal point of view, it gives you a linear oxygen, noble metal, oxygen bond. And I don't think it's changed since 1970. In 1970, platinum cobaltate was the only oxide of platinum that had ever been made. And the chemists were stressing it was the linearity of this bond that even made it possible.
So I was wondering about this very high conductivity. If anybody has discussed that this could actually be some kind of Kosterlitz-Tauless superconductor that doesn't quite make it to that because it's, you know, 3D coupled, but the coupling is very small, so it could be some superconductor on some length scale corresponding to.
So I don't know if anybody's discussed it, but some people have thought about it, and yeah, you do wonder. The resistivity of palladium cobaltate is also very unusual in its temperature dependence at low temperature, because to all intents and purposes, it's completely flat. So it's even flatter than you would get for Bloch Grüneisen. So, and when you fit that resistivity, you find that with temperature, it comes on exponentially, and the numbers look very good for a model where, and this is not yet any superconductivity, it looks very good for a model where you have phonon drag going on, and Piles' original idea of the 1930s, that you would, the phonons, normal electron phonons processes wouldn't contribute to resistivity at low temperature. And the first one you would see would be electron phonon umklapp. So the exponential onset looks very good because we know what the umklapp gap is. And that works out well. So that would be our attempt to say why the resistivity looks that way. But other possibilities might also exist.
I would say maybe the exponential onset would also be consistent with KT, right?
Yeah, indeed. So, yeah, I mean, I have mentally speculated about this before. I'd be very interested to discuss that with you more in the break. I mean, observationally, I should say, none of them show traditional superconductivity, but they're very broad conductors.
In these strongly correlated layers, I think you mentioned that in one material there's a kind of like 120 magnetic order.
I'm sorry, I'm not picking up what you're saying.
Sorry. In the strongly correlated layers, I think in one material you mentioned there's like a 120-like magnetic structure.
Yeah.
Is there, in other materials like this, is there evidence for other kind of magnetic structures or broken symmetry kind of in the strongly correlated layers?
Okay, so the Dellafossite series is extremely rich. There are, I'm guessing, there are tens of atomic combinations. I've concentrated on the metals because that's what interests me. There are many magnetic insulators, and those magnetic insulators actually show a richness of magnetic structure. I'm completely non-expert on that, but for instance, Ashwin Vishwanath is one of the few guys from our field who's also worked on Dellafossite, but he was interested in trying to explain magnetic structures that were being seen in the insulator. So it's not the case. Some of them are reasonably simple magnetic structures. Even this one is very controversial. It's 120 degree like when you project it onto the planes, but the spin orientation along the C-axis is far from trivial, and there are still big arguments going on about whether or not it's a magnetic structure that has an intrinsic chirality. So the anomalous quantum Hall effect brigade are very interested, and they believe the Hall effect and the magnetic one looked unusual, and they would like to explain it in terms of this exotic physics, but they need an exotic magnetic structure. And the jury's still out whether you've got it or not in the chromate.
Any other question? Okay, so if not, let's think.
I think Bruce had his hand up.
Wait.
So just to follow, so in the chromate, right? There are local moments associated with the chromium that are Bohr magnetons that are the sorts of things. Is there any evidence for that in the metallic cobaltate or the rhodate or any? Because, you know, given that it's a triangular geometry, you could have a disordered magnetic texture of some sort.
Okay, so there is... The crystals we're working with are very small. In order to do DC DC susceptibility, just squid susceptibility, guys from our group have looked at bigger crystals. I get worried at that point because it's very clear that what's being looked at isn't actually just palladium, you know, some flux sticking to it and everything. They certainly see the evidence that there are some Curie moments. The density that they're inferring is not so high, parts per thousand. And I don't think we have enough evidence to be able to say whether or not that's repeatable. In the early days, in the 90s in Japan, in polycrystals, they saw pretty big Curie tails. But then there's a paper saying that they went and did NMR to try and look at the local fields really in the bulk of the material, and their conclusion was that susceptibility was purely poly-like.
Okay, I think I'm going to wrap up and thank Andy for a very interesting talk.